1957. Massasoit had given his son both an exit strategy from Mount Hope and an army to take up his cause. In the months ahead, Philip continued to cut his coat to pieces as he ritualistically secured the cooperation of sachems from Connecticut to modern Maine. By this means, William Hubbard wrote, Philip kindled the flame of war wherever he went. Chapter 14. The God of Armies. Upon the return of her husband in August to her family's home in Duxbury, Alice Church did as many a soldier's wife had done before and has done since. She almost instantly became pregnant. In the months ahead, as a son grew in the womb of Alice Church, the war that had begun in New England's oldest colony spread with terrifying speed to the newest and most distant settlements in the region. The frontier of Massachusetts, which included the Connecticut River Valley and modern New Hampshire and Maine, erupted into violence, while a sudden and eerie placidity came to Plymouth. As they all knew, it was yet another calm before yet another storm. The war in Massachusetts had begun in earnest on August 2nd with the Nipmucks' attack on the town of Brookfield, one of the most isolated settlements in the colony. Set in the midst of the wilderness between the towns outside Boston and those along the Connecticut River, Brookfield possessed just 20 houses and was a day's journey from its nearest neighbor, Springfield. As happened with frightening frequency in the months ahead, the fighting began with an ambush. A diplomatic delegation from Boston, hoping to establish peace with the Nipmucks, was suddenly attacked from a hillside overlooking the forest path. 8 English, including 3 residents of Brookfield, were killed, with just a handful of survivors managing to ride back to town. Soon after their arrival, several hundred Nipmucks descended on Brookfield, and one of the most legendary sieges in the history of New England was underway. For 2 days, 80 people, most of them women and children, gathered in the home of Sergeant John Ayers, one of those killed in the ambush. When the Indians were not burning the rest of the town to the ground, they were firing on the house with guns and flaming arrows, forcing the English to chop holes through the roof and walls so that they could douse the fires. At one point, the Nipmucks loaded a cart full of flaming rags and pushed it up against the side of the house. If not for a sudden shower of rain, the garrison would surely have become an inferno. Finally, on the night of August 3rd, 50 troopers under the command of Major Simon Willard came to the rescue, and the Nipmucks dispersed. With the attack on Brookfield, inhabitants throughout the western portion of the colony began to fear that they would be next, especially when the Nipmucks moved on Lancaster on August 22nd and killed 8 English. On August 24th, a council of war was held at the town of Hatfield on the Connecticut River, where concerns were voiced about the loyalty of the neighboring Indians. A force of 100 English was sent out, and the Indians, many of whom did not want to go to war, had no choice but to join the fight against the English. What became known as the Battle of South Deerfield resulted in the deaths of 9 English and 26 Indians as the war quickly spread up and down the river valley. When 4 days later a tremendous hurricane battered the New England coast, the Indians' powwows predicted that the number of English dead would equal the number of trees blown down in the woods. On September 3rd, Richard Beers was sent with 36 men to evacuate the town of Northfield. Unaware of the Indians' use of concealment as a tactical weapon, Beers led his men into an ambush and 21 were killed. On September 17th, a day of public humiliation was declared in Boston. Colonists were told to refrain from intolerable pride in clothes and hair and the toleration of so many taverns. But the Lord remained unmoved. The following day proved to be, according to Hubbard, that most fatal day, the saddest that ever befell New England. Captain Thomas Lathrop, 65, was escorting 79 evacuees from the town of Deerfield. They were about to ford a small stream when several of the soldiers laid their guns aside to gather some ripe autumn grapes. At that moment, hundreds of Indians burst out of the undergrowth. 57 English were killed, turning the brown waters of what was known as Muddy Brook bright red with gore. From then on, the stream was called Bloody Brook. For the Indians, it was an astonishingly easy triumph. The heathen were wonderfully animated. Increase Mather wrote, some of them triumphing and saying that so great a slaughter was never known, and indeed, in their wars, one with another, the like hath rarely been heard of. But the fighting was not over yet. Captain Samuel Mosley and his men happened to be nearby, and they heard gunshots. By this time, Mosley was widely known as Massachusetts Bay's most ferocious Indian fighter. An early proponent of the doctrine that the only good Indian is a dead Indian, Mosley refused to trust native scouts and had nothing but contempt for the colony's praying Indians. In August, he countermanded orders and burned the wigwams of the friendly Penacooks in New Hampshire. Soon after, he seized a group of praying Indians on a trumped-up charge, strung them together by the neck, and marched them into Boston for punishment. Since Mosley was related to the governor and was now a popular hero, he felt free to do anything he wanted. He also enjoyed shocking the authorities back in Boston. That fall, he blithely related in official correspondence that he had ordered a captive Indian woman be torn in pieces by dogs. There was no Englishman the Indians hated more, and when Mosley took the field at Bloody Brook, the Nipmuc warriors shouted, "Come on, Mosley, come on! You want Indians? Here are enough Indians for you." For the next 6 hours, Mosley and his men put up a tremendous fight. Scorning the natives' scattered style of warfare, Mosley ordered his vastly outnumbered men to remain together as a unit as they marched back and forth through the natives' ranks, firing relentlessly. After hours of fighting, Mosley was forced to ask his two lieutenants to take the lead while he, according to Hubbard, took a little breath, who was almost melted with laboring, commanding, and leading his men through the midst of the enemy. If not for the arrival of Major Robert Treat and some friendly Mohegans at dusk, Mosley and his men might have been annihilated. The next day, 64 Englishmen were buried in a single mass grave. Less than a month later, on October 5th, the Indians fell on Springfield. By day's end, 32 houses and 25 barns had been burned. Several mills had been destroyed, and tons of provisions. In all of Springfield, only 13 of more than 75 houses and barns were left standing. I believe 40 families are utterly destitute of subsistence. John Pynchon, son of the town's founder, wrote, "The Lord show mercy on us. I see not how it is possible for us to live here this winter. The sooner we are helped off, the better." Pynchon, who had been named the region's military commander, was so shaken by the devastation that he asked to be relieved of his duties. Prior to the attack, Springfield had enjoyed a long history of good relations with the local Indians. For many Puritans, the burning of Springfield proved once and for all that all Indians, friend and foe alike, were, in Hubbard's words, "the children of the devil, full of all subtlety and malice." In this climate of mounting paranoia and racial bigotry, the presence of the praying Indians, situated in their own self-contained villages within a 30-mile radius of Boston, became intolerable to most New Englanders. When the minister John Elliott and Captain Daniel Gookin, superintendent to the praying Indians, dared to defend the Indians against unsubstantiated charges of deceit, they received death threats. Finally, Massachusetts authorities determined that the praying Indians must be relocated to an internment camp on Deer Island in Boston Harbor. On the night of October 30th, hundreds of praying Indians were gathered at a dock on the Charles River. As they prepared to board the three awaiting ships, a scene startlingly reminiscent of the Pilgrim's departure from Delfshaven was enacted. Gookin related how submissively and Christianly and affectionately those poor souls carried it, seeking encouragement and encouraging and exhorting one another with prayers and tears at the time of the embarkment, being, as they told some, in fear that they should never return more to their habitations. The ships left at midnight, and in the months ahead, hundreds of Indians died of starvation and exposure on the bleak shores of Deer Island. By the end of October, New Englanders were desperate for even the most meager scrap of positive news. So many refugees from the towns to the west had flooded Boston that Pynchon's replacement as military commander, Major Samuel Appleton, was instructed to forbid any more inhabitants from leaving their settlements without official permission. Massachusetts Bay and Connecticut were already beginning to run low on food, and in October, both colonies embargoed trade in provisions. Some of the bloodiest scenes of the war had occurred in coastal Maine, where the scattered settlement pattern made the inhabitants particularly susceptible to Indian attack. In the months ahead, conditions became so desperate that some Massachusetts authorities considered the possibility of building a palisade wall from the Concord to the Charles Rivers and abandoning all the territory to the north, west, and south to the Indians. Since this would effectively have cut off all the settlements in Maine, New Hampshire, and the Connecticut River Valley, the wall was never built. Adding to the fears and frustrations of the English was the elusiveness of the man who had started the conflict. By November, Philip had become an almost mythic figure in the imagination of the Puritans, who saw his hand in every burning house and lifeless English body. In the years to come, traditions sprang up in the river valley of how Philip moved from cave to cave and mountaintop to mountaintop, where he watched with satisfaction as fire and smoke arose from the towns along the blue necklace of the Connecticut. The truth, however, is less romantic. Instead of being everywhere, Philip appears to have spent much of the summer and fall holed up near the modern Massachusetts-Vermont state border. While he and his handful of poorly equipped warriors may have participated in some of the victories that season, Philip was certainly not the mastermind behind a coordinated plan of native attack. Indeed, there are no documented instances of his having been present at a single battle in the fall of 1675. Instead of being heralded as a hero, Philip appears to have been resented by more than a few Indians in the Connecticut River Valley. One well-known warrior in the Hadley region even attempted to kill the Poconoket sachem, alleging, an Indian later recounted, that Philip had begun a war with the English that had brought great trouble upon them. Although unsuccessful, the assassination attempt indicated that Philip was hardly the dominant and controlling force the English claimed him to be. Rather than looking to the Poconoket sachem for direction, the Nipmucks and the River Valley Indians, as well as the Abenakis in New Hampshire and Maine, were fighting this war on their own. With Philip having vanished like smoke into the western wilderness, and with unrest and fear growing by the day among the English, colonial authorities needed a foe they could see and fight. To the south, occupying a large and fertile territory claimed by both Massachusetts and Connecticut, but presently a part of the infidel colony of Rhode Island, was the largest tribe in the region, the Narragansetts. To date, their sachems had signed two different treaties pledging their loyalty to the English. However, many New Englanders believed that the Narragansetts were simply biding their time. Come spring, when the leaves had returned to the trees, they would surely attack. "This false peace hath undone this country," Mary Pray wrote from Providence on October 20th. The colonial forces determined that as proof of their loyalty, the Narragansetts must turn over any and all Poconokets and Pocassets who were in their midst, especially the female sachem Weetamoo. When an October 28th deadline came and went, and no Indians had been surrendered, the decision was made. "The sword having marched eastward and westward and northward," Increase Mather wrote, "now beginneth to face toward the south." Some Englishmen privately admitted that if the Narragansetts had chosen to join Philip in July, all would have been lost. As the Nipmucks assailed them from the west, the far more powerful Narragansetts might have stormed up from the south, and Boston would have been overrun by a massive pan-Indian army. But instead of acknowledging the debt they owed the Narragansetts, the Puritans resolved to wipe them out. The United Colonies of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Plymouth determined to mount the largest army New England had ever seen. From now on, all hope for negotiation was lost. In December, 1,000 soldiers, representing close to 5% of the region's male English population, would invade the colony of Rhode Island, which refused to participate in the attack. The leader of this mammoth force was to be Plymouth's own Josiah Winslow. Serving as General Winslow's trusted aide was none other than Benjamin Church. Winslow had originally requested that Church command a company of Plymouth soldiers, but he had declined. In his narrative, he gives no reason for the refusal, saying only he craved excuse from taking commission. Church was still angry over the enslavement of the Indians the previous summer. In addition, it's probable that he had his doubts about the efficacy of attacking a huge and so far neutral Indian tribe. But there may have been other, more personal reasons for turning down the commission. As his decision to settle in the wilderness of Sekonnet might indicate, Church preferred to do things his own way. And as the Pease Field fight had shown, he enjoyed being in charge. Being part of a vast English army was not something that appealed to him. But when General Winslow proposed that he serve as his aide, Church was unable to resist the opportunity to advise the most powerful person in Plymouth Colony. Church and Winslow rode together to Boston. After meeting with Massachusetts officials, they headed to Dedham Plain, where more than 450 soldiers and troopers were assembling as similar groups gathered in Taunton, Plymouth, and New London. Quotas had been assigned to each colony, with 527 soldiers coming from Massachusetts, 158 from Plymouth, and 325 from Connecticut. The Massachusetts forces were under the command of Major Appleton, a veteran of the war in the Western frontier, with the companies under his command headed by Captains Mosley, Isaac Johnson, Joseph Gardner, Nathaniel Davenport, and James Oliver, and a troop of horse under Captain Prentice. The Connecticut forces were under Major Treat, another veteran commander, with Captains Nathaniel Seeley, John Gallup, John Mason, and Thomas Watts heading up the companies. Plymouth's two companies were under Captains William Bradford and John Gorham. December 2nd was declared a day of prayer throughout New England. According to Increase Mather, the churches were all upon their knees before the Lord, the God of armies, entreating his favor and gracious success in the undertaking. On December 8th, Winslow and his soldiers departed from Dedham. After a night at Woodcock's garrison in modern North Attleboro, the army arrived at Seekonk along the Seekonk River. Winslow ordered Church to sail directly for their next destination, Smith's garrison in Wickford, Rhode Island, while he led the troops on the land route through Providence. That way, Church could prepare for his arrival. It also provided Church with the opportunity to share a boat ride with the redoubtable Samuel Mosley. By this time in the war, Mosley was almost as mythic a figure as Philip himself, while Church, with the exception of the Pease Field fight, had accomplished almost nothing. If word of Church's righteous indignation over the enslavement of the Indians at Dartmouth and Plymouth had reached Mosley, the former privateer would undoubtedly have viewed the Plymouth carpenter as misguided and weak. It could only be hoped that General Winslow would not rely too heavily on the advice of his soft-hearted aide. For his part, Church resolved to prove that he was as skilled at capturing Indians as anyone in New England. Church had been ordered to prepare for Winslow's arrival, but instead of remaining at Smith's garrison in Wickford, Church teamed up with some brisk blades from Rhode Island and set out that night in search of Indians. It was a cold December night, but they had the benefit of a nearly full moon. By sunrise the next day, Church and his men had returned to the garrison with 18 captive Indians. As it turned out, Mosley had also been out that night, and he too had captured 18 Indians. Winslow and his army had already arrived by the time Church and Mosley returned to Wickford. The general, pleased with the exploit, Church wrote, gave them thanks, particularly Mr. Church, the mover and chief actor of the business. There were two Indian children in Church's group, and Winslow decided to make a present of these likely boys and send them to friends in Boston. The general grinned at Church and said that his faculty would supply them with Indian boys enough before the war was ended. As Winslow had made clear last August, slaves were one of the spoils of war. Moseley had captured an Indian named Peter, who, because of a falling out with one of